Monday, October 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. coalition says it struck a second mosque in Syria. We get some reflections on the late Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and Pakistani female carpenters ply their trade. It's all ahead. The U.S. military says it targeted a second mosque today in Syria, blaming ISIS for putting civilians at risk. I'm joined by VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what's known about what happened?
Well, we know that this is the second time in recent days that the Islamic State has used a mosque as its command and control center to directly target members of the Syrian Democratic Forces. I was speaking to a Pentagon spokesman, Sean Robertson, and he told me that they were directly targeting the Syrian Democratic Forces when the decision was made to conduct that strike on the mosque. I spoke to another Pentagon spokesperson, Colonel Robert Manning. He was saying that this is just typical of the Islamic State, that they are brutal and they are putting civilians at risk during these operations. They're not supposed to use a mosque or a hospital. These are supposed to be considered off limits in the law of land warfare, but by using these, they say that the United States had no other choice but then to conduct these attacks, or to conduct these strikes, I should say, on the people attacking their allies.
Is it known how the U.S. military made the determination, how they gained this knowledge that ISIS was there?
Colonel Manning did say that in-depth monitoring made the United States aware of when only Islamic State fighters would be present. It's still too soon to tell. This strike just happened today, so we will be finding out in recent days if there are any civilian casualty reports that are being made, and the United States military says that they will investigate any credible reports of civilian casualties, but they don't like to share exactly how they find out this information. But they do say that this is a pattern. Using these type of buildings as a shield has become a pattern in recent weeks that they call desperate by the Islamic State and unprofessional and uncivil.
Well, in addition, there's a lot going on at the Pentagon today. The U.S. sent two warships through the Taiwan Strait. What did a Pentagon official say about that?
That's right. The Pentagon says that these two ships, the USS Curtis Wilbur and the USS Antietam, conducted a routine Taiwan Strait transit. They said that this was in accordance with international law. And the interesting thing about this, I should point out, is this was not a freedom of navigation operation. We hear about those a lot from the U.S. military. Freedom of navigation operations, typically done in the South China Sea or the East China Sea, they focus on areas of international waterways where there are disputed claims, perhaps China and Indonesia or China and Vietnam or anywhere where there is a disputed claim of territory. That is not the case here in the Taiwan Strait. This is international waters. No one claims these waters, so this was just considered a routine transit. So I asked officials afterward, after a briefing we had today, I go, well, then why are you announcing this? How is this any different from, you know, transiting in any point in the Pacific Ocean, for example? And they said, we did this based on transparency. We did this because this is so close to the Chinese, and we did this because we had been asked about it, and we again wanted to be transparent and not try to hide anything.
Well, this is a move, though, that could anger China.
Absolutely. China has been angered by a lot recently. Taiwan's relations with the Chinese have deteriorated throughout the year. In fact, since 2016, when the independence-leaning power party swept into power, and China has increased its military and diplomatic pressure, conducting air, sea exercises around the island. And then we have this trade war with the Chinese between the United States and China as well. So a lot going on that has put Beijing upset over many things. But the Pentagon says that this should not change the relations because of the transparency and because this has happened before.
All right. Thanks very much, Carla. That's Carla Babb reporting from the Pentagon. Some of the top news stories that are trending. NATO says a service member was killed in Afghanistan. Cameroon's Paul Biya wins a seventh term. Legal claims against the results are rejected. President Trump says the U.S. will now begin cutting aid to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, and Pakistan and Russia begin a joint anti-terror military drill. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
In a minute.
On August 21st, 2017, a total solar eclipse followed a northwest to southeast path across the United States. A number of researchers from various scientific disciplines used the solar eclipse to conduct experiments. Researchers at the University of Missouri put together a group of citizen scientists, along with elementary students and their teachers, to study how a solar eclipse affects bees. 16 acoustic monitoring stations were placed along the total eclipse path in Oregon, Idaho, and Missouri. The monitoring stations were placed in locations where bees would congregate, such as flower patches. As the total eclipse made its way over each monitoring station, the researchers listened for the sound of bees buzzing, or as they found out, not buzzing. During the periods of totality, the bees took a break from their daily routines. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Pakistani women carpenters work in their trade. Saudi Arabia says Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman spoke Monday by phone with the son of slain journalist Jamal Khashoggi to express condolences for the killing. Khashoggi died after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, on October 2nd. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is vowing to reveal details about the case in a Tuesday speech to his parliament. Cairo reporter Edward Uranian spoke with Jamal Khashoggi numerous times. During a phone conversation in the fall of 2017, Khashoggi expressed support for a new democratic system in Yemen, as he did for other Arab countries as well.
Saudi Arabia also needs to believe truly in democracy for Yemen. I think the Saudis are also reluctant, as much as the Iranians, about democracy. Each country wants to impose its blueprint in Yemen.
Uranian spoke to me from Cairo about his talks with Khashoggi.
I first spoke with Jamal when I arrived in Cairo back in 2008. I've spoken to him repeatedly over the years, and probably one of the more memorable times I spoke with him was, I believe, several years ago. I can't remember if it was two or three now, perhaps two and a half, when he told me that he was not able to answer my questions that time because he had been told not to talk to journalists. And I told him I hoped he would hang in there, and I hoped that we would be able to speak once again. And as it turned out, we were, because he left the country. He had also gone to Bahrain at one point within, I guess, the last 5 to 7 years. I think he probably thought that it was a little bit farther away than Riyadh, but not quite out of the country or out of the region. And ultimately, that didn't pan out either. The Saudi government has fairly close ties with Bahrain, and I guess he felt that it was still too hot to be there as well.
So I guess when you first met him, he was still based in Saudi Arabia, and then I guess it was about a year ago that he moved to the United States.
Yes, I spoke with him initially. I believe he was at the time the editor of several publications. I think Al-Watan was one of them, and Arab News in Saudi Arabia as well. And, I mean, I could check his cell phone numbers. Over the years, I've had a cell phone number for him, I believe, in Jeddah and one in Bahrain, as well as when he went to Washington. But he's moved around. He's also, before that, he's been to many countries and lived sort of the life of Saudi politics in the region and as far away as Afghanistan, I guess.
What were some of his opinions that got him into trouble with Saudi authorities?
It would seem on the surface of it that he wasn't entirely pleased with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's reform efforts. He said at one point when we were discussing those reforms that he hoped they were successful, because if they weren't successful, it would reflect badly on everyone, and that he feared that Saudi society in general was not being engaged and that just certain portions of it were being engaged. And he's reflected on the Arab Spring at various points when we've talked about his admiration for the Arab Spring and how he wished that it had been successful and that at some point it will be successful and that there will be democracy in Arab countries. Of course, at the same time, some of his detractors have said he's belonged to the Muslim Brotherhood. We've never discussed that. But I mean, I know he has some Islamist views, and David Ignatius of the Washington Post wrote in an article about 2 weeks ago that Khashoggi was a Muslim Brotherhood supporter during his youth, but, quote, had moved to more mature ideas about democracy.
Apparently, he had been spending a fair amount of time in Turkey. His fiance was based there. Did you have any contact with him when he was in Turkey?
No, I would not call Turkey from Egypt. Relations between Egypt and Turkey are very bad, precisely for the reason that many people point out, that Turkey, the Turkish leader, President Erdogan, is a Muslim Brotherhood supporter. A lot of Egypt's opposition is based in Turkey, and Turkey has many Arabic language TV stations that support the Muslim Brotherhood, which led to, of course, some of the accusations that Jamal was a Muslim Brotherhood supporter. Whether he was or he wasn't, I still liked him. He was a very nice chap, and he had a very funny sense of humor.
Well, and he was certainly very well known among journalists, international journalists as well.
Well, at some point over the years, he's probably been one of the few English-speaking Saudi journalists that have been willing to comment to the English-speaking press, probably because he was close to former Saudi intelligence chief Prince Turki, who was also the ambassador to Washington at one point and the ambassador to London. And he was very close to the Saudi leadership over the years and was close to King Abdullah, who reportedly liked him. But of course, King Salman is only a half-brother of King Abdullah, and they had different views. And the Muslim Brotherhood has been outlawed in Saudi Arabia, and as it is here in Egypt in recent years. So someone with Islamist points of view would not be looked on favorably.
And Khashoggi was also part of a well-known family.
Yes, his uncle is the well-known Saudi arms dealer Adnan Khashoggi, Khashoggi as they say in Arabic. He was based in various places over the years. I remember seeing his yacht based in Monaco. He traveled very widely and allegedly cut arms deals with many countries and was the middleman in many conflicts in the Arab world between Iraq and Iran, in Afghanistan. And, of course, that did lead to some accusations that Jamal was tied up with Islamic groups because the Saudis supported the Islamic resistance in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. Of course, the United States did as well, which is where it's difficult to separate government policies and points of view.
Edward Uranian reporting from Cairo. The Kremlin expressed concern Monday about U.S. President Donald Trump's pledge to pull out of a key Cold War arms deal with Russia, saying the move would make the world a more dangerous place. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters Russia has not violated the treaty, and if the United States goes on to develop new missiles, then Russia would be forced to respond in kind. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton is in Russia meeting with top officials after Trump said the U.S. would pull out of the 31-year-old treaty. Trump spoke with reporters Saturday before a campaign rally in Arizona.
They've been violating it for many years, and I don't know why President Obama didn't negotiate or pull out. And we're not going to let them violate a nuclear agreement and go out and do weapons, and we're not allowed to. We're the ones that have stayed in the agreement, and we've honored the agreement, but Russia has not, unfortunately, honored the agreement. So we're going to terminate the agreement. We're going to pull out.
Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker suggested this might be a ploy by Trump to get Russia back into compliance. Fellow Republican Senator Rand Paul opposes the U.S. decision.
I think it's a big, big mistake to flippantly get out of this historic agreement that Reagan and Gorbachev signed. This was a big part of Reagan's legacy, and we should not get rid of it. It was an important step. We went from 64,000 nuclear-tipped missiles down to 15,000. It has been an historic agreement. I think what we should do instead of getting out of it is I've asked the president, and I've advised him privately and in public, that he should appoint nuclear negotiators, nuclear arms control negotiators, to actually work with the Soviets. We have complaints that they're not in compliance. They also have complaints that some of our missile launchers in Europe are not in compliance. Let's have a rational discussion with experts on this and see if we can resolve it.
Paul said he fears a renewed nuclear arms race if the U.S. withdraws. Binoy Kampmark, senior lecturer in global studies at Australia's RMIT University, was asked by International Edition's Victor Beatty whether Russia is indeed violating the terms of the accord.
It could be argued that in terms of their deployment of certain intermediate ballistic range missiles, that in a certain sense they've been violating it for years because of the proximity of the weapons they have, say, within range of certain European targets. But the reality is that since the agreement was signed in 1987 between then Premier Gorbachev and, of course, President Reagan, there's been an understanding that these sorts of weapons should be restrained and controlled in terms of their deployment because they're deemed to be destabilizing in the strategic environment. So that limitation seems to be challenged, as many things, of course, have taken place under the Trump administration because they want to reorientate their outlook more unilaterally, which seems to be the case.
Russia's threatening retaliation. What might that mean?
Well, retaliation can't really take very concrete forms in this case other than, for example, deploying certain weapons, upgrading certain weapons. There is recent figures demonstrate, of course, that the Russian Defense Ministry has been spending huge amounts on upgrading and modernizing the nuclear forces. So it's evident that Putin is very aware about these sorts of tendencies, and I have no doubt that some of this has also been encouraged by the volatility of the Trump administration, too, and its security outlook. So Where this will be seen will be in terms of expenditure on weapons, in terms of testing types of these intermediate range weapons, even though heaven forfend would never see them used. But this is the ongoing strategic battle between these two powers.
This must be alarming to America's NATO partners.
Yes, it's very alarming because there has been an ongoing dispute about the nature of this weapon, certainly through the Cold War and when it became a big issue in the 70s when the Soviets developed these intermediate-range weapons, the reason being that, of course, the Soviets could exact a strategic advantage over the United States by attacking its bases in Europe and, of course, various targets within a certain vicinity, which is one of the reasons why these things were pushed in the 80s, and an understanding that both sides would try to come to an agreement and restrain the deployment of these types of weapons.
Could this be treated similarly by the Trump administration regarding the NAFTA agreement with Mexico and Canada, a trade agreement that he tore up and that he renegotiated? So could this possibly be renegotiated?
Well, yes, that's absolutely right. And I think you make a very good point that what tends to happen in terms of the cycle of ceding, destruction, withdrawal, and repudiation is that in its place comes an option, comes a particular set of new variables perhaps to consider. And in terms of discussions, I'm sure President Trump and President Putin will have things to say, but I also do see that they will come to some kind of other arrangement. The reality is that these are not the sorts of things you play too much with, and eventually, even though there's a lot of theatrical bluster about it, they will probably come to some agreement to replace the nature of the 1987 agreement. So that's something that I anticipate happening.
Binoy Kampmark of Australia's RMIT University. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Carpentry is traditionally considered a man's job in Pakistan, but a few brave women are changing that mindset. From carving unique wooden utensils to building an entire house, VOA spoke to several women who wanted to hammer home the point that not only are women integral to their community and the economy, they can also build things as well as the men. This report, produced in the remote Hunza Valley in northern Pakistan by VOA's Urdu service, tells their story. It's narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Mera naam Amna, aur main carpentry mein kaam karti hoon.
My name is Amna. I am working as a carpenter. I am the master carpenter here. My friend Gulshan and I started this back in 2008, and now there are 43 women in our carpentry group.
The Agha Khan Development Network in Pakistan, a non-profit organization known for community development, started this project 10 years ago to make women more self-sufficient. And in a country where men are often the sole breadwinners, more than 100 women have now been trained to work in various fields, including carpentry.
It felt strange at first, holding a saw and other tools. It seemed very difficult, but once we got used to it, we liked it. We thought we would never leave this field. Soon after, many other women joined too.
Many of these women did not finish their education, but some have now become skilled carpenters. One told us she's supporting her family while doing what she loves.
My dad passed away a long time ago. I really wanted to get an education, but I did not have resources to complete it. I thought I should not only support myself, but my family too.
Carpentry is considered a man's work in Pakistan, and women are often discouraged from doing it.
At first, it was difficult for us to do this kind of job, given our societal mindset. It was not acceptable for a woman to do a man's job. People would say, why don't you learn sewing or knitting or become a teacher?
But Farman Bibi didn't want to sew or knit or teach. She had other plans. She's earning enough now to complete her education and still help her family.
We had many financial issues, which is the reason why I joined. Now I support the household and am completing my education. I helped my younger sister get her master's degree and helped my brother with his schooling.
In many countries around the world, women are already crucial contributors to a healthy economy. Despite the challenges they face, Aguila says it is time for Pakistani women to do the same.
Wherever women go, they face issues that will affect their honor, religion, culture, and social norms. However, when they step out and do something in order to take care of their family, then they realize that their honor, religion, culture, and everything is still in place.
Others say the biggest hurdle for women in Pakistan is the lack of freedom to make their own decisions.
Political and religious leaders often come to lecture us on what women should do. They never allow us the opportunity to think in terms of what we want as women.
Amna and her peers have become trailblazers in their own country. And they told VOA that they are determined and eager to help other Pakistani women understand that not only is it possible for a woman to be self-reliant, it's also good for the financial health of their families. For VOA's Urdu service, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.